The Leah Harrington Show. Sponsored by Step Finance, your go-to DeFi portfolio manager on Solana. BitMEX, the OG crypto derivatives platform and the best place to buy your Bitcoin.
Things really are just starting to heat up.
Hey guys, and welcome back to another episode of the Leah Harrington Show. So this podcast, as you know by now, is sponsored by the OG crypto derivative exchange, BitMEX. So some really great news for them. They've actually recently launched a spot exchange, which basically means you can now easily buy and sell Bitcoin and many other cryptocurrencies on that platform. It's actually a brand new interface, super slick, super easy. It's an amazing place to buy and sell your crypto. So definitely recommend them. Also, I want to make sure that we do say thank you to them, because on this show, we do talk about a lot of supposedly controversial things like freedom, authoritarianism, some things which people would call conspiracy theories, which are proving to be true. So without BitMEX, we wouldn't be able to provide you such important conversations. So huge thank you to BitMEX. And if you are interested in signing up and, you know, buying your crypto through them and buying your Bitcoin through them, then I'm actually going to leave a link for you in the description. And all the information is there. So a huge thank you and a massive shout out to BitMEX. So let's kick this off. Today, we're having a little bit of a different conversation, so I'm very excited to get it going. Joining me today is Nick Bhatia, the author of Layered Money. Nick, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. For those that don't know, I read the book. I reread it this weekend. I really enjoyed it. It has an amazing background of the history of money and sort of how we got to where we are today. So massive thank you for coming on. For those that don't know who you are, can you give us just a brief background about you?
Sure, absolutely. I come from the traditional finance world. I used to be in the investment management industry. I was a bond trader. I traded treasuries and other interest rate products, and then moved on to the strategy and research side of fixed income. Before falling down the Bitcoin rabbit hole and starting to write about topics like Lightning Network, Bitcoin-derived interest rates, and Bitcoin as a reserve currency. So in about 2019, I decided to leave behind my traditional career and go full-time as a Bitcoin writer. And I wrote Layered Money during the pandemic 2020 and published it in January of 2021.
So why did you decide to leave? What happened at that point?
Well, basically, over the course of 2016 to 2018, as I was learning about Bitcoin and started to write about Bitcoin, I could see the writing on the wall that the traditional industry as it stood at that time was not going to last. It wasn't going to last forever. And as a young person, I want to go to where the world is going, not where it is today. And I just saw that Bitcoin would be absolutely at the center of world finance going forward for the next few decades. And that's really why I decided to just learn as much as I could about Bitcoin. Then at a certain point, I had written several articles about Lightning Network and Bitcoin that had achieved some popularity in the Bitcoin community. And basically, I got some encouragement from people to continue writing about Bitcoin. And so I just took the leap of faith and left my career behind and started the teaching and writing phase of my career.
I think that's such a big leap. I mean, it's not a big leap when you are so convinced, right? But it is a big leap in terms of leaving something that you just know very well and it's something that you're comfortable with. So you said that you just knew the traditional system sort of had an expiry date, basically. What's not going to last about it?
So the way that money is created today in the fractional reserve way, I believe it's unsustainable because the dollar itself has lost its form. So back in the day, we're talking about 100 years ago, when the dollar was still convertible to gold, it had some backing, right? It had a sense of an anchor. But today, 50 years removed from the gold standard, and also 15 years removed from the onshore dollar system being the only thing that the Federal Reserve BACs. And I'm referring to in 2007 when the Fed issued a central bank swap line to the European Central Bank and the Swiss National Bank that basically made the euro and the Swiss franc as derivatives of the dollar in a monetary hierarchy sort of way. So we have really long lost any reality of the dollar. It is pervasive and it is across the world in terms of what people use, their denomination, and then all of these other currencies are derivatives of the dollar. So everything is denominated in this system, but it's so unstable that I just don't see it lasting in its current form the way that it is. I see that Bitcoin being an impetus for change. We see that the central banks are now announcing their central bank digital currencies. So their system in the future will be derived off of this new central bank digital currency mechanism. And the current mechanism really will be dying out.
You mentioned fractional reserve banking. And I want to make that really clear for people who don't know exactly what that is. So can you explain it to us? And also, number one, why is it bad? And then once you explain that, explain why isn't it illegal?
Sure. So fractional reserve banking is this idea that the money that you have in your checking account on deposit is issued to you by a private bank, not by the government and not by the central bank. And so how does the bank issue that money to you? They lend it into existence. And that lending process is done based off of only a fraction of the total amount of money that they lend held in reserve, either in the form of government bonds or reserves held at the central bank. So in that way, the amount of base money in the system is multiplied because only a fraction of it needs to be held in reserve for a bank to issue money. So we have, why is it bad? Because then we have more money in circulation than is actually reserved or that actually exists at the base layer. And that can cause runs on the bank and financial crises. Unfortunately, the fractional reserve system is more or less inherent in human tendency. So why isn't it illegal? Because people, human beings, accept fractional reserve issued money as real money, and they only demand the real money in crisis, and the time between that happening is long enough for people to accept it, really.
It's so fascinating because that it shouldn't be. I don't know even if it's people accept it. I feel like it's because people just don't know and aren't aware. Because if your money isn't, you know, backed by whatever it's supposedly backed by, like let's just say 1-to-1 with gold or something like that, then surely it just becomes worthless.
I agree with you that people don't know that their money is fractionally reserved today. They don't inherently understand that. But there are times throughout history where the distinction is made very clear to people that a gold coin and that a piece of paper saying, I promise to pay a gold coin are not the same thing. And I think as you know, that's a lot of what layered money is about. Where we look at the history of money and at what point did people start accepting a piece of paper in lieu of a coin? And how did that change the way that we do business as a society? And I believe that the benefits from this way of using a layered money system outweighed the costs and advanced our society and our economy forward. Now, I'm not making a judgment as to at what point did it go too far, but I do point out that over the course of the 1930s to 2007, that the dollar, because of this layered money system and its complexity, basically the dollar lost its sanity and its credibility. It doesn't mean the dollar died in 2007. It doesn't even mean the dollar is going to die in 2027. But what happened in 2007 is that the dollar, it made the world understand that the dollar isn't real anymore. It can, it might stay alive for another 50 to 100 years, but that it's just not real anymore. And then we have the rise of Bitcoin. And so a lot of Bitcoin's rise can be explained by the fact that the dollar, it doesn't have that reality. And so people have to express that view via something. So real estate prices increase across the world, commodity prices increase across the world, including gold. And then we have the birth of Bitcoin, which explodes in value from zero to half a trillion to $1 trillion. So if you want to explain why Bitcoin exists, you can attribute some of it or all of it to this idea of the dollar losing an anchor or a reality during the 2007 to 9 financial crisis. And honestly, the subsequent actions of the Federal Reserve and other central banks since that time.
So I'm going to delve into all of that in a minute, because I want to really make clear, you know, what is layered money and like how Bitcoin comes into it, and really also just like what level Bitcoin falls under. But we'll get into all that. I want to actually just get your take just on current events, you know, like quantitative tightening that's about to start. So in your opinion, do you think it's too late given inflation has already hit astronomical levels? And once this really does kick in, what does this mean for the everyday person right now?
Sure. So I would direct people, viewers, to my Substack publication called The Bitcoin Layer. People can find it at thebitcoinlayer.substack.com. I just published a couple hours ago a piece on quantitative tightening and quantitative easing, and really trying to explain it for the average person that isn't necessarily familiar with the ins and outs of monetary policy. So that's what my publication is about. It's about research, analysis, and education about Bitcoin and macro, things like this topic. So what is QTE? What is quantitative tightening? Well, to answer that, we have to answer, what is QE? QE is quantitative easing. What is QE? QE is a way for the Fed to ease interest rate policy when rates are already at zero. So we know that the Fed brought rates down to zero in 2008 during the financial crisis, but things weren't going as much as they wanted them to, and they didn't want to lower rates into negative territory. So what did they do instead? They bought bonds in an effort to try to lower interest rates in other parts of the economy. By providing an extra source of demand for those bonds. That didn't work, so then they bought more bonds. And actually, the second time that they bought bonds, rates didn't go down, they went up. And why? That is really important to understand. Why did rates go up during QE2 and QE3 and QE4 instead of down? When the Fed was buying treasuries, that buying of treasuries should send yields lower, because when prices go up, yields go down. But it didn't. It sent yields higher and treasury prices lower. Why? Because of a trader psyche. When the Fed is printing money or doing QE, it raises confidence. So you sell the risk-free asset and you buy risky stuff. It sends yields higher. And so the Fed in 2015 started raising rates when they were at zero. And then by 2017, they said, we're going to start doing QT, lowering the size of the balance sheet. And so QT is the opposite of QE, and QE is buying bonds. So QT is letting those bonds mature and not replacing them. And in that way, QT destroys money, because QE is the creation of money. So with rates at 8%, inflation at 8% right now, the Fed is trying to tighten monetary policy in two ways. by sorry.
Take your time. You're giving us good
The
information
Fed
here. We need a smooth voice for us.
takes my breath away sometimes in what they're doing. So the Fed is raising rates, so they're tightening policy, they're raising rates, but they're also starting on June 1st today, letting treasuries mature. And that money now is coming out of circulation. The balance sheet is decreasing. And so the source of demand for those bonds is now gone from the market. Now, when they did this in 2017, 18, instead of sending yields up, it sent yields lower because of the confidence thing. Without the Fed's liquidity, the Fed creates this fear. And then investors purchase treasuries because they're scared. And so they buy the risk-free asset and they sell the risky stuff. So the Fed's intent with QE and QT versus what actually happens empirically is very interesting to observe. It's not the same. And right now, we can expect that the double tightening, higher rates, and QT will basically slow inflation and growth. And so it's not too late. We're going to see inflation and growth come down. We're seeing it starting already. And how long will the Fed be willing to tighten? And that's the question on everyone's mind. And that's what I've been writing a lot about at my publication. I'm watching the 2-year yield, seeing when that is coming down materially. That might put pressure on the Fed. I'm also watching stocks, of course, but I'm really watching the Fed's reverse repo facility, which is this concept of the excess reserves in the system. Right now, it's at $2 trillion. So the Fed will destroy money. I promise you guys, the Fed will be destroying money. QT will be going on because there's $2 trillion in excess reserves. When does it stop? We don't know. But for now, they're going to go for it.
The question on my mind is why are we in such a mess with inflation? Because we're taught that those that govern are supposed to be competent, are just good at their job, the experts know what they're doing. So I often end up thinking that it's destruction by design. I don't think that they're that incompetent. What's your take?
The inflation is due to many things, and I think that it's fair to attribute the inflation across a bunch of mismanagement from government and central banks. It is fair to attribute the inflation to supply chain disruptions due to shutdowns and a lot of the response to the pandemic. Okay, a lot of the supply chain disruptions cause prices to spike across the economy, commodities, input prices, transport prices, labor disruption, all of that stuff is causing supply side driven inflation, without a doubt. And it's actually probably the primary driver. Okay. Now we also have 4.5 trillion of QE that was also done during this time, which creates excess reserves in the system. It creates confidence, it creates excess borrowing, spending, and that drives inflation too. So QE also contributes to that. And they go hand in hand, right? So and honestly, the immediate response QE in the height of the pandemic versus the subsequent extended QE well into 2021, it's actually obscene. I'll be very honest with you. The immediate response was, okay, you have this shock, you have to provide, but then several trillion more of QE to follow was really unnecessary. The evidence is the $2 trillion in excess reserves parked back at the Fed. It means they went $2 trillion too far, or at least $1.5 trillion too far. So a ridiculous amount of QE that they did, okay? But attributing inflation to exactly the Fed or to the governments that make all the mistakes would be, I think, too singular. It's really attributed to all of these things. And it's attributed to, in my opinion, not letting the free market adjust. Because if the free market would adjust, we would have deflation be allowed, where companies fail, banks fail, defaults happen, and then prices come down, which brings demand out of the woodwork ready to support the economy again, a natural cycle. That's what I believe, while at the same time acknowledging that governments have to respond to voters, so they bail out people, companies, banks when it fits their policy, when they see that that can get them reelected. And I'm sympathetic to the people, the individuals that need help when they get fired. For example, unemployment insurance and those types of things. Government provides, you know, a fiscal stimulus to those people, and you know, if that contributes a little bit to inflation at the margin, it's of my opinion that that's okay. But you know, we have to also draw the line to where the free market response is allowed to happen. And in 2008 and 9, when we didn't let that happen to all the European and American banks, you set a precedent. And then that precedent, it's dangerous, because then you always have to bail out the banks. You can never let them fail, because it will tear down everything. And that's the moral hazard regime that we live in today, which absolutely drives some or most of the frustration that drives Bitcoin demand back again to Bitcoin. Here we are. So moral hazard with bank bailouts is once again like a big part of the fundamental demand for Bitcoin, at least, you know, in the first several years of its existence.
There's a quote in your book, which I absolutely loved, and it's really relevant to obviously what we're talking about. You said that governments are unable to resist the temptation to create free money for themselves. So explain then the problem with this. I know you've touched on it, but I do want to really make clear the problem with creating that free money. And then also what that means for this a standard level of skepticism that we should potentially have when it comes to government. Because if they can't resist creating money for themselves, then ultimately, are you saying that they can't help but be self-serving?
Yes. Governments, of course, are self-serving, and why can't they resist? Think about the olden days now, where gold is the only money, gold and silver. How do you get gold and silver? You have to mine it from the earth. And once it's above ground, it's hard to get because there's not that much of it. And then societies are forming, and gold and silver are used across the world for commerce. And then all of a sudden, a king decides to take the gold coins, suck out the metal in the middle, and put in steel instead, and wrap it in gold and silver. Is that fair?
No.
Full stop. I mean, really, that's really all we have to ask. Is it fair that the king puts steel in the middle of the gold coin and pretends that it's gold? Is it fair or not? And no, it's not fair. Why? Because it gives the king an advantage over everyone else. That's what we're talking about here. That's what Bitcoin does. It allows no one to fill the coin with fake coin. It prevents that forever, and everyone can verify that with their own software. All you need is a laptop or a phone. And so nothing that a king can do can affect Bitcoin. That's the juxtaposition here. Now, I take my research to the next level and try to explain as well all the things that are wrong with the internals of the dollar system and the mechanisms, and honestly, the inequity. Why is it unfair that they do this? What is it about QE that rings unfair for people and makes them frustrated with central banks and the ability for governments to create free money for themselves. Why does that frustrate them? Because they watch them do it.
Yeah.
You just watch the balance sheet increase, and you can watch the treasuries be purchased by the Fed, and you can follow the money, literally, that they create. And what do they end up buying? They end up buying government debt, which the government borrows to. And it's not even that the politicians are stealing the money and putting it into their checking account. Mm-hmm. But they borrow for their own political goodwill. And then they never have to repay that money because the Fed either purchased it or they just roll the treasuries over for the next generation. And it kind of like no one notices, right? They get away with it. But the frustration builds, the anti-politician stances build. And it's all because of the inequity that people feel when they see QE. And I don't want to pin it all on QE because it's not just the Fed's fault. Congress, when they borrow and spend, and then they argue both sides about the debt limit, the left is in power, the right says no debt limit, the right's in power, the left says no debt limit increase. Everyone is at fault when it comes to the fiscal side. And then the Fed is at fault for writing a blank check to the government. And the Fed is at fault for bailing out the banks and not letting them see retribution for their bad fractional reserve creation, right? It's the banks that did the bad fractional reserve that get bailed out. Because if they were full reserve, they wouldn't need a bailout. They'd be reserved, right? All of that is in play. And all of that leads to an emotion that drives Bitcoin demand. And, you know, for some reason today, Leah, you're asking me questions that are bringing up the political side and the frustration.
Yeah, it's very political.
From the populist side. It's not something that I write a whole lot about, but it's there. It's front and center. It's what was part of my journey as to like understanding the Fed and going down the monetary rabbit hole. It was 2010 QE2. I didn't know about Bitcoin. I had never even heard about Bitcoin until 2014 and didn't even read about it until 2016. But in 2010, I was like, what the hell is this QE shit? I mean, this is not fair. I was 22 years old, like a college student. Like, what do you mean you just create and then you buy? That's monetizing the debt. And try to explain to me that it's not monetizing the debt. And what is monetizing the debt? It means the central bank just creates money to fund the government. So the Fed says, we're not monetizing debt. We buy it from the banks. But the government issued it 2 weeks ago. So they were lying to me. And that set me off and really set me off down the path of never wanting to let the Fed get away with whatever they said they were going to do. Because I would know the math. Mm. And you wouldn't be able to lie to me because I would be able to observe the mathematics of your balance sheet and the effects that it has on the market and markets generally. And, you know, it ended up playing into, you know, my Bitcoin research career, because here we are, you know, as Bitcoin advocates and Fed watchers all at the same time. So it worked out well.
The monetization of debt that you're talking about, this is something which has always really confused me. So, and also since I'm not American, it's something which has always sort of been a bit of a question mark. But I guess it doesn't even have to be an American thing. I guess it's a global thing. But the relationship between the central bank and the government has always been really bizarre to me, because people always think that the Fed is owned by the state, and it's absolutely not. It's a private enterprise. So why are they in bed together?
The Federal Reserve is a bank of banks, yes, but they also have been issued their charter to furnish the currency. In the case of the Federal Reserve, they've been legislated by Congress and approved by the executive branch. So two branches of government instituted this charter for this bank of banks to basically furnish the currency of the country. So yes, it's a charter, but it was legislated into existence. And why? Because if we look back at history, the United States tried two different central banks in its early history. Both had 20-year charters, both expired. Then the United States went without a central bank for, you know, a century. And then they tried it again in 1913, and that one, that version of it has lasted. And if it was the people's will to remove that charter, they would vote politicians that ran on an anti-central bank platform. And so I don't want to minimize the importance of understanding how the Fed was created and what it is, but I, you know, it is the people's will via the legislative and executive branch to have this central bank. So I'm not out here advocating for end the Fed or keep the Fed. We have the Fed, and it is nowhere on either party or the populace's radar to move ahead. I mean, maybe some part of the right side has end the Fed as part of their platform, but it really hasn't even close to entered something that's on the national stage as to what we would do without the Fed or how we would transition to a world without the Federal Reserve. I think that's, it's really out of, you know, any immediate necessity for analysis. It's not in the will of the people to do it, but that is the case. It's a bank of banks. It was issued a charter in 1913. The charter has never truly come into question. And so it also makes the currency of the United States dollar, managed by the banks. Mm-hmm. Because it's their currency. It's not actually, the Fed will tell you that the dollar policy is the treasuries, but the quantity and price of the dollar is up to the Fed. So it's really the Fed's dollar. It's not the United States government's dollar. It's not the Treasury's dollar. And so that's the relationship as I would describe it today. It's not the clear, it's not the easiest to describe, but there are distinctions that we should make, you know, pretty clear.
Yeah, one of the things as well, which I thought was really fascinating, was this idea that the devaluation of money leads to government's eventual destruction. And you gave the Roman Empire as an example. So how does the cheapening of money lead to that destruction? And what does that mean for the dollar right now?
Yes. So devaluation of currency can lead to inflation in a direct way. That's what happens when you coin clip, or you mix silver with copper, or you mix gold with copper, and the coins actually lose. You call it the same thing, but you devalue it in that you remove value from the coin but keep the name. And that drives inflation, because people want the same amount of gold for their wheat, and so they charge more coins, so the price goes up because the amount of gold in the coin goes down. That's the direct relationship between devaluation and inflation. That direct relationship doesn't happen with QE. The Fed creates money digitally, buys treasuries from banks. The banks keep that money in reserve. They don't necessarily lend it out in the system. It doesn't necessarily drive lending and then higher demand and then higher prices, right? You see the first, second, third order of effects there as it works with QE. It's actually why the Fed did QE2 and QE3, because QE1 didn't even work to get it going. And yeah. So it's Kindle fire, but it's not direct. It's not a first order effect. And so part of what I, tried to do in the book was demonstrate that if people wanted to go back and understand why inflation can lead to societal collapse, you can go look at the Roman Empire and explore that. Now, I'm not an expert on the collapse of the Roman Empire. So I have to, put that out there as there was a correlation that I believed was true when I was doing my research during the time, that there was a correlation between the collapse of the Roman denarius coin and other Roman coins during the time due to devaluation, a 98% devaluation essentially over the course of a couple hundred years. And it did correlate with the fall of the Roman Empire. And so that is something that we have to take seriously from history. Fast forward till today, and then we see Zimbabwe and the hyperinflation there. And we also can use the Deutsche Mark in the 30s and resulting in the Third Reich, Nazism, and Hitler. And so we have some more modern examples of devaluation leading to hyperinflation. But back to your question, is hyperinflation there today? And is it a clear and present danger from the Fed's QE? We haven't had hyperinflation in a dollar-based way. We've had an inflation shock in 2021 and 2022. Granted, it's far from hyperinflation, no matter what metric you want to use. My cost of living is not 200% higher than where it was last year. So that is the case. But we also see the Fed attempting quantitative tightening for the second time in 6 years. They're trying to shrink this money supply. They're trying to destroy money, not print money. The simple act of the Fed raising rates and destroying money through QT is evidence that they have read their history books. I mean, giving the Fed the slightest bit of credit that maybe they don't deserve because of their patterns, but I will acknowledge that QT is an effort to destroy money.
You mentioned,
have to acknowledge that money printing and money destruction are opposites of each other. And even them trying to do it and starting it today is their attempt to protect the dollar. And so the more that they do it, the more that they get credit from the market of doing that. And so is the Bitcoin price going from 70,000 to 25,000 over a year, the last year's time, is that partially due to the Fed extending its credibility, pre-announcing QT and signaling for rate hikes? Potentially, yes, it is. Potentially, yes.
You mentioned at the beginning of the show that just because of the way the traditional system is run, it will expire at some point, hence your interest in Bitcoin. However, given you're sort of saying that, the Fed is doing QT and they are sort of trying to protect the dollar, how long do you think the dollar has left if you do actually think that it has an expiration date?
At least 20 to 50 years. It's so embedded in the way that everything works in this world that there's no way the dollar is going anywhere.
And you don't think there could be like a catalyst event or anything like that?
But what's the alternative? Is it gold? No. Is it Bitcoin? Absolutely not. Bitcoin is $500 billion in size. The US dollar spectrum is anywhere between $100 and $400 trillion, depending on how you want to denominate things or value things or strike, stock indices or all that. So we're talking about Bitcoin representing less than or about 0.1% of the size of the dollar today. So what is the alternative? Is it the Chinese renminbi? No. Is it the euro? God, no. So we have to, it's just, what is the alternative? There is no alternative. What's the alternative to the US military? What's the alternative to the US geopolitical position? What's the alternative to the US consumer as a source of global demand? We have to factor all these things in when we think about the longevity of the dollar. And we also have to factor in demographics. And so the way that the demographics are spelled out today, it doesn't, maybe in 50 years, we'll have some sort of African and Southeast Asian denominated world because of demographics. But it cannot happen from a secular cyclical point of view anytime in the next two decades, in my opinion.
So with that in mind, trying to understand whether Bitcoin is or isn't an alternative, what do you see the use case of Bitcoin then? Because a lot of people say Bitcoin is going to be the world's reserve currency. So from what I understood, you're sort of saying it's a definite no until potentially, 50 years from now, something like that.
So Bitcoin can be a world reserve asset, and it can be a global online currency, and it can rise dramatically and even exponentially while the dollar still is the world's denomination or the world reserve currency. So the rise can happen of Bitcoin, again, because of youth demographics and going towards 1 to 2 billion people using Bitcoin over the next decade. If and when that happens, Bitcoin as an online native currency becomes the standard in smaller denominations, maybe not for American company buying a British company. They might do it in dollars, but mom and pop transactions around the world might be completely Bitcoin denominated in 10 years. And I will point viewers back to a Substack post that I wrote for the Bitcoin layer a couple months ago or last month called Bitcoin versus quote unquote the dollar, because it's not really the best comparison. We should think about Bitcoin versus equities as something to own. Bitcoin versus real estate as something to own. Bitcoin versus your money market fund as something to own. But is Bitcoin a denomination today for like the NASDAQ to be priced in? No. Will it be that in 10 years? No. Right? All those companies will still be jurisdiction USA, right? Issued in the within the dollar spectrum. They might have prices in Bitcoin, and those prices in Bitcoin might even be the lead driver, like algorithms with algorithmic trading. You might have Bitcoin priced Apple shares leading the dollar priced Apple shares because algorithms link the markets. But that doesn't mean that the price on the NASDAQ will be in Bitcoin. It will still be in dollars. So this journey that we're on the next 10 to 20 years of Bitcoin becoming part of our financial society and part of our DNA digitally and emotionally too, like the word Bitcoin popping up in TV and movies and pop culture and all that kind of stuff. That's also part of it, right? The word dollar has been part of pop culture forever. Now the word Bitcoin is in there. So the transition will be gradual. It will not be black and white. Bitcoin and the dollar will coexist, and they won't even be thought of as necessarily competitors in the way that they're juxtaposed as competitors today. I think that it's a basic comparison, but when you really dive deeper into that comparison, we can see that it's not really the best. What's the best way to compare Bitcoin to gold and to US treasuries using the layered money framework? And comparing Bitcoin to, you know, London flats for Russian oligarchs, those type of mental exercises, you know, need to be thought of when we're trying to compare what is Bitcoin, what does it represent going forward?
Speaking of like the idea of layered money, this is what I thought was really interesting, because obviously, correct me if I'm wrong, but the first layer of money is the store of value, so gold, and then everything as you go down the layers become medium of exchanges, whether it's like banknotes or promises, or, you know, promises to repay. So the interesting thing about Bitcoin is, where does that stand in the hierarchy of money? Because it's the store of value, it can be the medium of exchange. And then is that for you what makes it unique to all other types of assets out there?
The layers of money refer to the hierarchy between a few things. Number one, the hierarchy of instruments. And the hierarchy of instruments depends on the hierarchy of balance sheets. And whose balance sheets are they? The financial institutions. So the layers are really about who owns what in the financial system. Where does it come from? So your checking account comes from a commercial bank. The commercial bank has other assets as its layer above your money. But gold is a commodity that comes from the earth. It's not issued by any financial institution, therefore it cannot exist as a second layer of anything. Gold is just is. And not only is gold is, but gold is purchased as the asset to issue money against by financial institutions, historically speaking, right? The banks own gold and they mark it as an asset, and then they issue gold certificates as money. And in that way, gold is the first layer of money. So what is Bitcoin? Bitcoin is the first layer of money because it's not issued by anybody. All you have to do is have a miner, a piece of hardware, and you can generate the coin on your own. And then any exchange like BitMEX can have Bitcoin on their balance sheet as an asset and then issue Bitcoin balances to their customers as a second layer form of Bitcoin. And it's all about the balance sheet. BitMEX asset, Bitcoin. BitMEX liability, Bitcoin deposit. And in that way, Bitcoin has very little historical precedent. The only thing you can compare it to is gold. And how insane is that? That you've actually invented something that you have to go back basically all of modern history to try to find a precedent, and you can only find one precious metal, which is, you know, God-given or earth-given. And so it really, in that by itself, bent a lot of people's brains, including my own, that you've actually created a first layer money that nobody issues. And it's a system that can keep itself without an issuer. Therefore, no counterparty risk, no default risk. And that can serve as the collateral for an entire financial system in the way that we saw a financial system developed between the 13th and the 20th century based off of gold. Again, that's what layered money, the first six chapters, are about. How we built a financial system based off of this pristine collateral called gold. We have a new one called Bitcoin, which sets the stage for, you know, a miraculous advance in monetary science, but we're in the, you know, absolute first stages of it, because people don't even recognize that it's the collateral that we've been waiting for. They still think it's like PayPal or, you know, some other second or third layer medium of exchange, when it's really a first layer of money and happens to do all those other medium of exchange functions. So it makes Bitcoin a, you know, once in a generation innovation.
That's good to know. That's what I was gathering when I was reading through. So I was like, okay, right, I'm getting this. This is making sense. But what's interesting as well is the term fix the money, fix the world. So I think it would be important at this point to just make clear how important money is. So do you feel that money is the center of everything?
Yes, you know, I do. And I do think that if you fix the money, you can fix a lot of the problems in the world. And that is why I am here. I don't advocate for any political position because I think this is so much more important, the money. That's why I focused on the Fed. I focused my career on Fed study, truly, because I believed that the money system was broken and I wanted to understand it. And I believed that if you fixed the money, it would do more than voting one way or the other. And I made that decision as a person in my early 20s and I've never looked back, you know, back. That's
like you stopped voting?
I'll say that I don't have any political energy to give. My right. energy is in this. It's in the monetary field. That's the best way I can answer your question. I don't believe that the political energy is where I should dedicate any of my effort, passion, or intellectual capacity to advocate for or against political positions. I want to focus on the monetary system and what is money and what it means. I believe it's broken. And, you know, I've dedicated my career to research and the education on the monetary front, you know, exclusively. So, you know, my viewers and readers will hold me accountable that, you know, I won't dabble in politics. It's not why I'm here.
That's so interesting because I always feel, although Bitcoin is apolitical, it just does have, and I can't help but feel it, these underlying kind of libertarian ideologies in terms of, you know, decentralization. So there isn't one authority which can dictate what has to happen. But I know a lot of people don't sort of agree on that.
No, I do agree with you. And, you know, I can admit that the political bias that gets, that people have that makes them attracted to Bitcoin can have that slant. And it's my slant as well that I believe in that. I believe in that freedom. That's part of, you know, but I express it now through Bitcoin. And I think that Bitcoin is the political platform because I can believe in Bitcoin. I don't have to pin my hopes on a politician or a political party or even a piece of legislation or the law in English language. I love math. And so Bitcoin is a mathematical political platform. And that's something that, you know, can excite, I think, anybody.
I understand. Just finally, what do you think about the future of decentralization? So, you know, we had kings and queens and then power sort of devolved to governments. We saw further devolution. Right now, personally, and we don't really need to get into this, but I sort of feel like things are becoming more authoritarian. There's more centralization. And so it feels like we're sort of going the other way. But do you think we're going to get onto this, whether it's a Bitcoin standard or a decentralized standard, whereby, you know, we see a lot more, decentralization of power, basically?
I think that you'll have the coexistence again of, you know, the dollar and Bitcoin. You'll have the coexistence of the more totalitarian side and the more completely decentralized, digital first, passport free sort of, you know, mentality. So watching that develop over and really watching Bitcoin's influence on that going forward is going to be very interesting. So I agree with you. We're seeing, you know, a move toward totalitarianism in many ways, at the same time, a move toward decentralization in many ways. So I think that the fact that we still have the growth of Bitcoin, despite everything else going on around the world, is a positive sign that Bitcoin will continue to see its own light, right? That we will continue to see a future in which Bitcoin is a part of people's lives. That will influence families, family offices, countries, companies, to go that direction. It'll influence politics as well. I don't have any strong prediction of how that will develop outside of the United States. I'm hopeful to see, you know, from my perspective, random, I don't mean that in any disrespectful way, but random countries coming onto a Bitcoin standard, like El Salvador and Central African Republic. They're random in that they don't have a position in the global economy, but it's not random that people or leaders from small countries want to explore a new monetary reality. So they will randomly appear on our scene, but in those countries, it will feel like a natural evolution. So I as long as we see that, and then, you know, from a United States perspective, I completely believe we will see states go full Bitcoin. You know, I look to Texas and what they're doing, and so we'll have jurisdictional arbitrage all over the world.
Totally agree with you. Jurisdictional arbitrage is a great way to put it. I think we're already starting to see that anyway, in terms of the pandemic and medicine mandates and all sorts of things. Some are more authoritarian and totalitarian than others. So that's pretty interesting.
Just cross the border.
Just go up north a little bit.
That's right.
Yeah, exactly. But Nick, it's been such a pleasure. I want to thank you so much for coming on. How can people get in touch with you, follow your work? How can they buy your book, Layered Money?
Absolutely. So I appreciate you having me today, Leah. I had a lot of fun, great questions and great interview. Everyone can find all my links at layeredmoney.com. So that's layeredmoney.com, links to the book on Amazon, Audible. People love the audiobook. You also have a link right at the top to my Substack publication called The Bitcoin Layer, or you can find that directly at thebitcoinlayer.substack.com.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Nick. It's been such a pleasure. And thank you everyone for watching. If you enjoyed this video, please don't forget to hit the like button and also subscribe so you never miss a video and you help support the channel, because we have very important conversations here. And we try to wake people up and bring them to the better side. There you go. So Nick, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And also major thank you to the sponsors, BitMEX, Step Finance, and BlockFi. We will see you all next week. The Leah Heilpan Show.